Right, you guys can grab your seats, and we are going to continue that series in Proverbs. We're not done yet. We've got a few more chapters to go, but we're nearing the end of this series, and it really has been an incredible series. Like Joey said, as the preachers, it's been challenging because it seems like Proverbs is one of those books where there's 100 different ways to preach it, and I don't know if any one person has cracked the code on how to preach Proverbs. But whichever way you break it up, it will be edifying to you, and I hope it has been for all of you. So what we're going to do is we're going to look at Proverbs 28, the whole chapter. We'll start out, I will read that, and then we'll get into breaking it up a bit. So let's read Proverbs 28, beginning in verse 1. The wicked flee when no one pursues, but the righteous are bold as a lion. When a land transgresses, it has many rulers, but with a man of understanding and knowledge, its stability will long continue. A poor man who oppresses the poor is a beating rain that leaves no food. Those who forsake the law praise the wicked, but those who keep the law strive against them. Evil men do not understand justice, but those who seek the Lord understand it completely. Better is a poor man who walks in his integrity than a rich man who is crooked in his ways. The one who keeps the law is a son with understanding. But a companion of gluttons shames his father. Whoever multiplies his wealth by interest and profit gathers it for him who is generous to the poor. If one turns away his ear from hearing the law, even his prayer is an abomination. Whoever misleads the upright into an evil way will fall into his own pit, but the blameless will have a goodly inheritance. A rich man is wise in his own eyes, but a poor man who has understanding will find him out. When the righteous triumph, there is great glory. But when the wicked rise, people hide themselves. Whoever conceals his transgressions will not prosper, but he who confesses and forsakes them will obtain mercy. Blessed is the one who fears the Lord always, but whoever hardens his heart will fall into calamity. Like a roaring lion or a charging bear is a wicked ruler over a poor people. A ruler who lacks understanding is a cruel oppressor, but he who hates unjust gain will prolong his days. If one is burdened with the blood of another, he will be a fugitive until death. Let no one help him. Whoever walks in integrity will be delivered, but he who is crooked in his ways will fall suddenly. Whoever works his land will have plenty of bread, but he who follows worthless pursuits will have plenty of poverty. A faithful man will abound with blessings, but whoever hastens to be rich will not go unpunished. To show partiality is not good, but for a piece of bread a man will do wrong. A stingy man hastens after wealth and does not know that poverty will come upon him. Whoever rebukes a man will afterward find more favor than he who flatters with his tongue. Whoever robs his father or his mother and says, "There is no transgression," is a companion to a man who destroys. A greedy man stirs up strife, but the one who trusts in the Lord will be enriched. Whoever trusts in his own mind is a fool, but he who walks in wisdom will be delivered. Whoever gives to the poor will not want, but he who hides his eyes will get many a curse. When the wicked rise, people hide themselves, but when they perish, the righteous increase. And let me read verse 1 of chapter 29. He who is often reproved, yet stiffens his neck, will suddenly be broken beyond healing. Well, these are the words of God, and they have every application to us today. So my prayer is that we would understand these words and live by them. This past week, I had a couple of my buddies who I do a little Bible study with on Thursday mornings do a little assignment that was given to me years ago, and I thought I'd give it to them. And it was to give them a blank piece of paper to write a date on the top with their name saying, on this date, it was in about, I think I chose 40 or 50 years from now, this person passed away, dot, dot, dot. And then I gave them the paper and said, this week, I want you to write your own obituary. Think of that day. Who knows when it will be? God knows. But what do you want to be said about your life when you die? At first, you might think that's a bit of a morbid assignment. But then as you reflect upon the end of your life, the purpose is to help you gain perspective for today. How do you want to finish this race? How do you want to be known? And when you really think through that, it will define what you're pursuing and how you're pursuing it today. It's sort of like writing your own biography, an autobiography of sorts. And I love biography. It's actually one of my favorite genres of reading. If I'm going to read outside of scripture, I want to read biography. Because biographies are this fascinating compilation of a person's life put onto the pages that you're reading and you're holding, and you see their whole life from start to finish. Some of my favorite biographies, I brought them up here with me. One is called The Life and Times of Howell Harris. Now, nobody knows who Howell Harris is, and this book is actually hard to find, because Howell Harris ministered in Wales in a time when the great revival preachers were living, the George Whitfields and the Wesleys. And so he was really overshadowed, but he lived this incredible life. Howell Harris was a man who was bold, he was courageous, he was godly, and really considered by his contemporaries to be the greatest Welshman of the 18th century. Even men like Whitfield, who we know a lot about, looked at Howell Harris as a model to be followed, an example to follow in life. Let me read you a little excerpt about Howell. What a name, Howell. It's kind of fun to say. This is who he was. Oh, this is his own words from his journal. Listen to the prayer that this man prayed. I pray that I might know the will of God more perfectly, and whether his glory and the salvation of my fellow sinners were the only objects in my view. I had power, after examining this matter, to rely in all things on the strength of the grace that is in Christ Jesus, for power to carry me through the great work of sharing the gospel, and that if his honor should call me to suffer, to be imprisoned and tortured, I should find him a faithful friend in every trial, in death and to all eternity. And suffering, this man did. This man would go into angry mobs to preach the gospel. At one point, in fact, a page later, he tells the account of there's an angry mob in a town. They did not want to hear him preach. They were drunk. They knew these revival preachers were coming and kind of the attention they would gather. And so they were protesting. They were throwing rocks, tomatoes. They would even pull out all their horses and stampede and try to destroy the gathering. And at one point, a lawyer from the town, drunk out of his mind, comes up to Howell Harris with a pistol, puts it in his face, and pulls the trigger. And it doesn't go off. And Howell goes on to preach. In fact, there's an account he tells where he and George Whitfield are in the upper room of a house, and outside the commotion is gaining, and people are starting to stir up the crowds. And George Whitfield is terrified to go out because he's afraid he'll lose his life. And so Hal Harris rebukes him, marches outside, and Whitfield sheepishly follows. And they preach to the angry mob. Okay, I love stories of a life like that. Bold and courageous for the gospel. Because what it does for me is it reorients my priorities and it reshapes my perspective. And I read a prayer like that. Lord, help me to be consumed with two things, your glory and the salvation of souls, even if I suffer unto death. And then I think about what's preoccupying my mind. And I'm often rebuked, but then encouraged. Hey, I should pray the same prayer. I love stories like that. There's other biographies of men who led different lives. One of my favorites, The Faith of Christopher Hitchens, written by a friend of the famous atheist who spent hours with him debating, talking, driving throughout the Americas, talking to college students. Christopher Hitchens, that famous atheist. Listen to how his life is described from his close friend. Where is it? Page. Oh, I got the wrong page. I'm not going to be able to find it. Nope. That's not it. Okay. Wrong page. I'll tell you what he said, though. Hitchens, he said, from his youth, hated God. And so he made it his life ambition to war against God. Now, the weapons of his warfare that he chose were words. And so Hitchens was a brilliant mind and a technician of the English language. and he read broadly, not always so deeply, but he read broadly, and he wanted to rage against God, and so he picked up the weapons of words. And so Hitchens became this famous atheist author, and he would go into a setting like this amongst college students and debate and answer their questions, and he was just brilliant. If you watch his videos online, you'll see his quick wit and his insightful knowledge, and yet it was his ambition to destroy God because he hated God, and so he sought to deny God. And it's a sad story. As you read this, you might find some tears welling in your eyes as you hear of the bond of one man with another, his friend, and the one, a believer, pleading with Hitchens to see Jesus in his beauty, in his mercy and grace. And as far as we know, Hitchens went to his deathbed shaking his fist at God. That does something to me too, reading a story like that, because it reminds me that it doesn't matter the wealth you acquire, the notoriety you may have, everyone is going to die and stand before God, and it matters how you live. So what about you? Have you thought about your life? Have you framed up your life now through the lens of your death? What biography would be written about you? Proverbs 28 gives us two biographies. Biographies of two kinds of kings, but really two kinds of people. It's a very binary chapter, the wicked and the righteous. There's two categories, and the wicked go this way, the righteous this way. And these proverbs were speaking and comparing these two lives, these two paths that you could go on. Really, that's the entire book of Proverbs, isn't it? A father pleading with his children, don't go the way of folly, go the way of wisdom. It's very binary. These two paths, as much complexity as there may be on each path when you get into it, there are only two paths in life. The way of the wicked and the way of the righteous. And Proverbs 28 presents two biographical sketches of kings, one who chooses wisdom and one who chooses folly. Now, I want to help us remember something, because when we come to the book of Proverbs, we can be so displaced from its context when these were written. These are real proverbial sayings for real kings who had real problems. And you say, well, yeah, that's obvious. But what I'm trying to help us remember is that there were actual people with flesh and blood coursing through their veins who heard these words and read these proverbs and took directives for their life because of them. In fact, one man calls this section of Proverbs that we've been in from chapter 25 here to the end of 28, a manual for future monarchs, not the butterflies. Don't worry, Annalie. Annalie's scared of butterflies. It's an interesting fact about Annalie. You think about it, the caterpillars, they're not. Anyway, so not the monarch butterfly, but for kings. A manual for kings. If you want to be a future king, read Proverbs 25 through 28. And then choose your path, king. 12 times the word ruler or an allusion to ruler in this chapter alone. It's a very leader-focused chapter. And so what I want us to do, ultimately this is going to come back to you and me on the path we choose in life, but what I want us to do is to check out these biographies of the kings. So we'll look at this chapter in two points. The way of a wicked king is point one, and then you guessed it, the way of a righteous king is point two. Now, before we get to the way of a wicked king, I want to give us a bit of context here. Because these kings, if you go back to chapter 25, look at 25, these are the Proverbs of Solomon, which the men of Hezekiah, king of Judah, copied. So that's placing us in a historical time and place, and it's the time, it's the days of Israel, when Israel was being ruled by kings. Now, David has died. And Solomon's rule has come to an end. And we are introduced to, in the storyline of Israel, a multiplicity of kings who followed great King David. And so I actually want you to turn back with me to the book of 1 Kings. And we're going to go back and forth between 1 and 2 Kings and Proverbs 28. So you can keep a finger in Proverbs 28. Because I want us to look at what was happening with these ancient Israelite kings. The son of Solomon, the first king to take over after Solomon dies, his name was Rehoboam. And we read about him in 1 Kings 12. And if you see the little header over 1 Kings 12, your Bible might say what? What does the header say? What does it say? Yeah, acts foolishly. My ESV says Rehoboam's folly. Immediately, a line is drawn to Proverbs, because Proverbs is about wisdom and folly. And this first king following Solomon is a foolish king. A fool reigns in Israel. And if you were to read that chapter, you would see his first foolish decision was very proverbial. If you read a Proverbs like, whoever walks with wise will be wise, but the companion of fools will suffer harm. Well, guess what Rehoboam does? He becomes king. Instead of listening to the wise old counselors that would have led Solomon, he gets his homies around him, his buddies. They're all Gen Z, by the way. And like that Gen Z, you know, we just keep going through the alphabet. So they weren't Gen Z. They were millennials, Joey. And he gets his peers around him. And he says, how should I rule the people? And the wise men are saying, rule them kindly and fairly. And the young men are like, rule them with an iron rod. Don't let the people get away with anything. They are your slaves. And so Rehoboam, in his folly, listens to the fools and immediately suffers harm. The nation of Israel is like, oh, hey, there's Rehoboam's leader. Let's stone him to death. And they reject Rehoboam and they choose another king. And what happens in this chapter is the division of Israel from the northern kingdom to the southern kingdom because of Rehoboam's folly. Division and a lack of unity is introduced into Israel because of this foolish king. After that, it was a story of instability. As you read through 1 and 2 Kings, you will see, at points, you'll see kings rise up for a month before they're killed, and another king reigns. In fact, through in my Bible, I have gone through, and I'll write next to each king and their subsection, evil or righteous. Evil, righteous. So Abijam reigns in Judah in chapter 15, evil. Asa reigns in Judah, righteous. There's a lot more evil next to the king's names than there is righteous. During this time of these kings multiplying, prophets like Elijah and Elisha are mocked. The men of God are ridiculed and rejected. We hear stories like Elijah and the prophets of Baal and Jezebel and Ahab. These are the dark days of Israel. After King David dies, the dark days begin to descend in Israel because they are ruled by wicked men like Ahab. How often do we hear this refrain, and he did what was evil in the sight of the Lord? If you read through these chapters, you'll hear it over and over. In fact, if you're new to these chapters, it's kind of fun to go, oh, a new king, I wonder what he'll be. Evil, he did what was evil. And then rarely you'll find one, he did what was right in the eyes of the Lord, following his father David. Most often, it's evil. The dark days of Israel, how dark? Well, I was listening to these chapters on audiobook this morning as I was making chocolate chip pancakes for Felicity. And I didn't realize that Felicity was listening as closely as she was. And she said, Daddy, turn it off. I'm going to have nightmares. And I said, but baby, it's the Bible. And then I remembered, yeah, maybe I should. There's some stuff in here. Israel entered the dark days. Starving Israelites, when they were besieged by Syria, would eat their own children. Cult prostitutes of the pagan gods entered the land. In 2 Kings 15, we hear about an Israelite king besieging another city, finding the pregnant women and ripping them open. These are the dark days of Israel. How quickly the mighty have fallen from King David to these evil monarchs. And it's about to get darker because a new king is about to take the throne. Consider with me our first point for you note takers, the way of a wicked king. Enter King Ahaz. At this point, we are now in 2 Kings 16. So you can turn to 2 Kings 16. In the 17th year of Pekah, the son of Remaliah, Ahaz, the son of Jotham, king of Judah, began to reign. Ahaz was 20 years old when he began to reign. That's terrifying enough. A 20-year-old king. But look at how he reigned. He reigned 16 years in Jerusalem, and he did not do what was right in the eyes of the Lord his God, as his father David had done. Ahaz chose folly. Look at verse 3. But he walked in the ways of the kings of Israel. He even burned his son as an offering, according to the despicable practices of the nations whom the Lord drove out before the people of Israel. If you were going to go to the parallel account in 2 Chronicles 28, it reveals something even darker about that moment. It wasn't just one son that Ahaz burned alive. He burned multiple sons in the Valley of Hinnom. The Valley of Hinnom, known simply to the contemporaries as the Valley, was the place where Molech was worshipped. When the Greeks would refer to the Valley of Hinnom, they called it Gehenna, which we would say in English, hell. It was the place where children were birthed with the intention of putting them onto the arms of that pagan deity and lighting the flame as they screamed until they died, to appease that god, to smile upon the pagan nations. And Ahaz led Israel, the people of Yahweh, into the worship of Molech. He sacrificed and made offerings, verse 4 says, on the high places and on the hills and under every green tree. Friends, we are reading his biography. It's a one-chapter biography of this wicked king. And how is he remembered? For slaughtering his children in the most brutal way. But he did other things. In verse 5, we're told that the king of Assyria comes up against Israel to besiege it, and he can't. He's having some trouble, but Ahaz, his back is against the ropes. And so in his desperation, Ahaz, look at verse 7, sent messengers to Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, saying, I am your servant and your son. Come up and rescue me. Now, if you're familiar with the biblical story, Assyria was the most brutal pagan nation known to man. This is why Jonah, when Jonah was told to share the gospel, the mercy of Yahweh with the Assyrians, Jonah said, to hell with the Assyrians. I will not go there. I don't want them to be saved. And he ran as far away as he could. Why? Simply because Jonah was a grumpy old prophet? No. So wicked were the Assyrians that when God's mercy was put in the same sentence with their name, Jonah said, no way. Friends, the Assyrians were masterful torturers. They had a new technique for war. Instead of waging war and then subjugating the people to torture, they would capture several people from a city, torture them publicly and brutally before the city walls to show the city what would happen if they resist. And city after city would fold and let the Assyrians come in because they could not withstand the horrific tortures. Things I will not even mention. The brutality of the Assyrians. And the king of Israel, in his moment of desperate need, says to the Assyrians, I am your servant and your son. Rescue me. come, rescue me from the hand of the king of Syria and from the hand of the king of Israel who are attacking me. And then look at what he does to appease this pagan monarch. He strips the silver and gold that was found in the house of the Lord and the treasures of the king's house and gives it as an offering to the king of Assyria. He thinks of God, but only the treasures that are in his house, and he strips them bare and hands them to this wicked king and says, "You deliver me, please." Of course, the Assyrian king was more than happy to. He assisted this cowardly, wicked Israelite king, and they win the war. This chapter tells us that Ahaz goes and visits Assyrian territory, and he sees their altars that they've built to their gods, and he comes back to Israel and says, "Hey, remove the altar to Yahweh, and let's build an altar this way." And he actually places inside the temple pagan Assyrian altars. He is reorganizing the furniture in the temple of God to suit the desires of the worldly men he's trying to please. Look at verse 18. He covered the way for the Sabbath that had been built inside the house and the outer entrance for the king he caused to go around the house of the Lord. He's rearranging God's furniture. Why? Look at the last line. Because of the king of Assyria. Motivated by seeking to gain the approval of this wicked king. One man says this. Ahaz has left behind him the reputation of being among the worst, if not actually the worst, of all the princes of the house of David. He had neither courage, nor patriotism, nor energy, nor prudence, nor piety, nor even a decent regard for the traditions of his house and nation. How does it all end, this reign of Ahaz? Well, he dies, another king takes over in Judah, or in the northern kingdom, but we read in verse 9 of chapter 17, the people of Israel did secretly against the Lord their God things that were not right. They built for themselves high places in all their towns, from watchtower to fortified city. Now, for the sake of time, I won't read to the end of the chapter, but you should, because what you see next is God's divine judgment on the people of Israel. Look at verse 18. Therefore, the Lord was angry with Israel and removed them out of his sight. None was left but the tribe of Judah only. Exiled to Assyria, the people of Israel are conquered because their leaders rejected Yahweh. Now flip back to Proverbs 28. And let's see if we see King Ahaz here. Look at verse 1. The wicked flee when no one pursues. Cowardice. Look at verse 4. Those who forsake the law praise the wicked. Ahaz looked at wicked Assyria and praised them and sought them as his deliverer. Look at verse 5. Evil men do not understand justice. They look at a God that demands their children to be burned alive and say, "Yes, that is good. I will appease that God." Look at verse 9. If one turns away his ear from hearing the law, even his prayer is an abomination. Whoever misleads the upright into an evil way will fall into his own pit. Ahaz took the entire righteous nation of Israel into Assyrian idolatry. Friends, you can go through this whole chapter. Verse 16, a ruler who lacks understanding is a cruel oppressor. Verse 18, whoever walks in his integrity will be delivered, but he who is crooked in his ways will suddenly fall. Look at verse 1 of chapter 29. He who is often reproved yet stiffens his neck will suddenly be broken beyond healing. Friends, this is a biography of a king like Ahaz, a coward who introduces into the righteous nation chaos and judgment because he rejects God and he pursues wicked rulers and leans on his own understanding and pays the consequence of it. This is the way of the wicked. Now let's consider the way of a righteous king. Go back to 2 Kings. Look at verse chapter 18. Hezekiah is born, the son of Ahaz. Now, as he grows, Hezekiah witnesses some things like the burning alive of his baby brothers. He was 9 years old when Ahaz became king. He would have witnessed his infant brothers burned at the altar of Molech. He lives through Syrian invasion. And now, at 25 years old, he becomes king in Judah. And watch how Hezekiah acts. Look at verse 3. He did what was right in the eyes of the Lord, according to all that David, his father, had done. He removed the high places and broke the pillars and cut down the Asherah. He broke in pieces the bronze serpent that Moses had made. For until those days, the people of Israel had made offerings to it. It was called Nehushtan. He trusted in Yahweh, the God of Israel, so that there was none like him among all the kings of Judah after him, nor among those who were before him. For he held fast to the Lord. He did not depart from following him, but kept the commandments that the Lord commanded Moses. And the Lord was with him wherever he went out. He prospered. He rebelled against the king of Assyria and would not serve him. He struck down the Philistines as far as Gaza and its territory, from watchtower to fortified city. Hezekiah was different. Oh, what a picture of boldness and courage and conviction. He looks at these pagan deities that had infiltrated the land and says, smash them all, even the good one, the serpent that Moses had set up, but the people had idolized it. And so he smashes that too. And God is with him and prospers him. And you see what it says? He struck down the Philistines from watchtower to fortified city. It didn't matter where it was. If there were Philistines, he struck them out. He eradicated them. He was a man of victory and godly shedding of blood. Hezekiah was different. And in this line, if you were to kind of go back and read chapter after chapter after chapter of these kings, you would start to feel gross as you're immersed into the darkness of Israel, and then the bright light shines through of Hezekiah. And you say, why? Why was Hezekiah different? Go back to Proverbs. Told you to flip back and forth here. Keep your finger in 2 Kings 18. We're coming back. But why? Don't go to Proverbs 28. Go to Proverbs 25. These also are the Proverbs of Solomon, which the men of Hezekiah, king of Judah, copied. Hezekiah, at some point, watching his brothers being burned, seeing the chaos of Assyrian pagans ruling in Israel, at some point, when it came turn for him to rule, said, I am going to tap into divine wisdom. And so he has his men scurry and search and find the wisdom of Solomon. Collect it all, put it together, assemble the words of the divine Yahweh. Find wisdom from Solomon. I need to take a different path. And so his men gather for him very real proverbs, real scrolls, and bring them before a very real king who looks at them and says, how am I going to rule this nation? What decisions will I make? Hezekiah, king of Judah, tapped into divine wisdom. Oh, and he did. Go to Proverbs 28 and just listen to the description of the righteous. The wicked flee when no man pursues. Yeah, but the righteous are bold as a lion. Those who forsake the law praise the wicked like Ahaz, but those who keep the law strive against them. Didn't you hear that in the description of what he did? He was striving against Assyria. He was striving against Syria. He was striving against the Philistines. He was righteous, and so he opposed those that his father had welcomed in with open arms. He didn't turn his ear from hearing the law. He pursued the law. These proverbs defined Hezekiah. And I want to give you an illustration. Look at verse 12. When the righteous triumph, there is great glory. There was Ichabod in Israel. The glory of God had departed Israel until Hezekiah. The kings of Israel were folding under the pressure of the nations around them until Hezekiah. And I want us to see that in dramatic fashion. Go back to 2 Kings and go to chapter 18, because something happens that puts all of this on grand display. Beginning in verse 9, Shalmaneser, king of Assyria, comes up against Syria and besieges it. This is the northern kingdom. Assyria takes the northern kingdom. A year later, in verse 13, Sennacherib, which is a ruler in Assyria and a messenger, comes Sennacherib is the king. The Rabshakeh is the king's messenger, comes to Judah, the southern kingdom, where Hezekiah is, and wants to take the southern kingdom as well. And initially, if you read through verse 16, Hezekiah begins to falter. His faith begins to fail him. And he actually does what his father did. He goes to the temple and starts stripping the gold to give it to the Assyrians because he's afraid. Look at verse 17. The king of Assyria sent to the Tartan, the Rabsaris, and the Rabshakeh with the great army from Lachish to King Hezekiah at Jerusalem. And they went up and came to Jerusalem. When they arrived, they came and stood by the conduit of the upper pool, which is on the highway to the washer's field. And when they called for the king, there came out to them Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah, who was over the household, and Shebna the secretary, and Joah the son of Asaph the recorder. And the Rabshakeh said to them, "Say to Hezekiah, thus says the great king, the king of Assyria, on what do you rest this trust of yours? Do you think that mere words are strategy and power for war? In whom do you now trust that you have rebelled against me?" So Assyria is at Hezekiah's doorstep saying, "Hold on, Hezekiah, you don't rebel against me." Verse 21, "But you are trusting now in Egypt, the broken reed of a staff." Verse 22, "If you say to me, 'We trust in the Lord our God,' is it not he whose high places and altars Hezekiah has removed, saying to Judah and to Jerusalem, 'You shall worship before this altar in Jerusalem'? Come now, make a wager with my master, the king of Assyria. I will give you 2,000 horses if you are able on your part to set riders on them. How then can you repulse a single captain among the least of my master's servants when you trust in Egypt for chariots and horsemen?" He's mocking their lack of infantry. And then he says, "Moreover," verse 25, "is it without the Lord that I have come up against this place to destroy it? The Lord said to me, 'Go up against this land and destroy it.'" Then Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah, and Shebna and Joah said to the Rabshakeh, "Please speak to your servants in Aramaic, for we understand it. Do not speak to us in the language of Judah within the hearing of the people who are on the wall." You know what they're saying? Don't scare everyone. They're speaking to the Assyrian leaders saying, "Shh, you're scaring the people. We'll take your message to Hezekiah. We'll give you what you want, but don't let them know that you're going to destroy us." And listen to what they say. The Rabshakeh said to them, "Has my master sent me to speak these words to your master and to you, and not to the men sitting on the wall who are doomed with you to eat their own dung and drink their own urine?" That was an Assyrian torture technique, which we're not going to get into. Then the Rabshakeh stood and called out in a loud voice in the language of Judah, "Hear the word of the great king, the king of Assyria. Thus says the king, 'Do not let Hezekiah deceive you, for he will not be able to deliver you out of my hand. Do not let Hezekiah make you trust in the Lord by saying, "The Lord will surely deliver us, and the city will not be given into the hand of the king of Assyria." Do not listen to Hezekiah, for thus says the king of Assyria, make your own peace with me and come out to me. Then each one of you will drink his own vine and each his own fig tree and each drink the water of his own cistern." And he goes on saying, "Surrender and you'll have peace. Don't let Hezekiah deceive you." As chapter 19 opens, Hezekiah receives word of the Assyrian threat. And look at what he does. He tears his clothes, covers himself with sackcloth, and where does he go? Into the house of the Lord. Now, you've got to understand, this king is terrified. Objectively, Assyria is the greatest threat in this ancient world, and Hezekiah is, he doesn't have a military match for this mighty nation, and so he runs to God. And he finds in the house of God the prophet Isaiah. Verse 3, this is a day of distress, rebuke, and disgrace. Isaiah says to them, look at verse 6, do not be afraid because of the words which you heard with which the servants of the king of Syria have reviled me. Behold, I will put a spirit in him so that he shall hear a rumor and return to his own land, and I will make him fall by the sword in his own land. Hezekiah receives a word from God, I will deliver you. Now, if you remember in Proverbs 28, notice when we go back how often it says deliverance. The righteous will be delivered. The righteous will be delivered. Those who trust in the Lord will be delivered. And Hezekiah lays everything on the line as he's being threatened with women and children behind him as the ruler of this nation. He's saying, Yahweh, what do I do? And the word of God is, don't be afraid. You will be delivered. Now, I wish we could spend so much more time in these chapters. Go read chapter 19 and look at the prophecy of Isaiah. He prophesies of Sennacherib's fall and Assyria's downfall. But what I want you to notice is this. Look at verse 35. Chapter 19. That night, the angel of the Lord went out and struck down 185,000 in the camp of the Assyrians. And when people arose early in the morning, behold, these were all dead bodies. Then Sennacherib, king of Assyria, departed and went home and lived at Nineveh. In other words, the Lord delivered Hezekiah, and he delivered his people. Wisdom vindicated, Israel delivered. God wins. Now, I've done my best to kind of give you a little biographical sketch in these chapters. Just like I give you a little hint of these books. Hey, this is a good book, this is a good book. You've got to go and read this in depth and see, spend time, and you'll see all of these incredible details. You'll see the faltering of Hezekiah's faith. Because the righteous are not perfect men. They're weak men like you and me, who apart from the power of God would be more like Ahaz than Hezekiah. And so there are times when Hezekiah doubts and fears and says, I can't do this. And yet where does he go every time with those doubts, with those fears? He runs to the house of Yahweh. He doesn't go to the kings of Assyria. And he casts himself prostrate on the ground. It's one of the most beautiful demonstrations of Hezekiah's humility. He falls on the floor and says, Yahweh, deliver us. And we see that victory. Okay. As we close, back to you and me. Remember, these are real proverbs for real people who led real lives. And what I wanted to impact you with this morning is that Hezekiah was a real man who really read the very words that you are reading. He had his men assemble these very words, and then in the moment of his darkest despair, stuck to it. As the Assyrian army is outside his gates, he's reading Proverbs 28 going, those who trust in the Lord will be delivered. When the righteous triumph, there is great glory. I don't know how, and I'm terrified, but I'm going to trust these words. How about you? Have you really taken these 28 plus weeks that we've been in Proverbs and then looked at your life and applied it? My friend, if you are feeling like you're reacting to life around you and you're having to rearrange the furniture in the temple to appease these worldly influences because well, I can't stand up to my boss, and I can't go against the grain here, and all my friends are doing it. You need Proverbs. If your life is out of control and chaotic and unhinged, and you're feeling like, what am I doing? And I certainly don't feel delivered, and I don't feel righteous, and I don't feel like I'm prospering. My friend, you need Proverbs. You really actually need to put your eyeballs on these words and commit to them and say, Lord, open my eyes to see the truth of your word and then to follow it. And here's where it begins. The second half of this chapter, Proverbs 28, is all about the future king's relationship with Yahweh. That's why it starts in verse 14, blessed is the one who fears Yahweh always. Friends, that's where it begins in your life. And Christian, that's where it continues in your life, fearing Yahweh. And the fear of Yahweh is not the fear that Hezekiah had of the Sennacherib outside of his door. The Sennacherib gave threats. If you don't come out, we will torture you. Your children, your women, all of you. That sent shockwaves of fear. But Hezekiah wasn't only dealing with that fear. He had another fear, a greater fear, the fear of Yahweh. The reverential, awe-filled fear of the king of the universe, not the king of that nation. And he lived by that fear, which means he went to that king in desperation in time of need. And he relied on the words of that king because he knew that king. And here's the incredible reality for you and me. This Yahweh, he's made himself known to you. When Jesus Christ entered this world, he was revealing Yahweh to you, to bridge the gap between wicked Ahaz-like kings running around this earth, to turn us into faith-filled, dependent worshipers like Hezekiah. And you can live a life of boldness and courage and strength and wisdom if you know that king. You're going to have a lot of kings that are scary in your life. It's called the IRS. It's called that boss that you realize on day one of accepting the job, this isn't going to go well. You're going to have a lot of kings, circumstances, terrifying circumstances, where you say, there's no way 185,000 soldiers are going to be defeated. Did you hear what the Sennacherib said? Hey, we'll give you 2,000 horses if you can put men on them. They didn't even have 2,000 men to put on horses. And there's 185,000 standing outside the gate. You're going to have those moments. Will you go to the book of Proverbs for real solutions for real problems? Will you go? Will you tap into the divine mind of Yahweh to live your life? Okay, these are cool books with cool covers. We're not all going to have books written about us. But you are going to have an obituary written about you. What will it say? Which path will you choose? Father, help us to be the wise who, like Hezekiah, fear the Lord, turn from evil, and trust in him. Give us wisdom. Thank you for making wisdom incarnate in Christ, allowing us to be introduced. I pray everyone in this room would not leave this room until they know that wisdom. It's in his name we pray. Amen.